Very much. It is an honor to be here. I know that this kind of seminar can be difficult for some people, and as I mentioned last night, it's not the easiest thing that I do in my work. My work is composed primarily of helping preachers. My father was a preacher for over 50 years in the same church for 43 years, and he loved young preachers. And so, my brother and I developed the Jenkins Institute to encourage young preachers. We believe that our schools do a great job of training young men to become preachers. We have some outstanding schools. I'm fortunate I do some teaching at Bear Valley, and I do some teaching at Sunset, and I serve on the Board of Trustees at Freed Hardeman. And so I think our schools do a good job. What happens a lot of times is when you graduate from college, you get out into the real world, you know, it's not like it was in college. And the schools don't have the resources and the people to encourage the young men in oftentimes in isolated places where they don't have a continuing education, where they don't have a lot of churches. And so that's where the Jenkins Institute comes in. We come in and try to encourage preachers. I'll be flying from here tomorrow to Columbus, Ohio, and we'll be meeting with an eldership on Monday. We'll meet with a preacher's luncheon. About 50 preachers from all over Ohio will be coming in, and we just talk with them about ministry and encourage them. And then we'll fly Tuesday morning to Nashville, and I'll be speaking Wednesday night in Nashville, and then Thursday morning fly from there to Orlando, Florida, and be a part of what's called the Equip Conference, and I'll be talking to preachers in Orlando. There'll be about 100 preachers or so there, from all over the state of Florida and other places. And so just kind of go from, then I go home for 2 days, and then I can't remember where next, but it's just kind of from place to place to place, and people say, well, where do you live? Well, my home address is Dallas, Texas. Actually, it's Flower Mound, Texas, and we lived there in Flower Mound for 18 years, my wife and I 17 years, and then when she passed away, I sold our house. We had lived in that house for 1 year, and I sold that house and moved into an apartment. And I stayed in that apartment for almost 2 years, and I got to looking one day at my schedule, and I noticed that I slept two nights in the month of June and two nights in the month of July in that apartment. And I got to figuring what that was costing to sleep in an apartment. And I know housing is expensive everywhere, but the apartment was costing me over $1,000 a night to sleep. And I thought, this is foolish. And I thought, I could save some money. And so I talked to my kids. I don't know how you do if you've lost your spouse, but I don't make any major decisions in my life. It's not turned on. Now it's turned on. Can you hear me any better now? I don't know how you do, but in my life, I don't make any decisions without running it by my children. Now, isn't that odd that we're asking our children for advice? So I don't make any big decisions without talking to them. Now, I don't usually do what they say because I want them to know how I've felt all my life. But I do talk to them, and I said, I'm thinking about getting out of the apartment, and they said, sounds great to us. That means more money for us down the road somewhere. So I live in hotels. I literally... For the end of August, I will have lived in hotels for 1 year. And there's some things about it that are not the best in the world, but there's some things about it that I really like. I don't have to clean the place. I get free internet service and cable. I don't watch TV, but free TV. And they come in and make my bed every day. And so that's a good thing. So that's kind of where I am in my life. I saw some people have some fans. I want to know how many people are really members of the Church of Christ here. How many of you remember funeral home fans? Okay, you remember? Okay, those funeral home fans they used to give you. When I was a kid, my grandfather lived in North Alabama, and he went to church at the Friendship Church of Christ. And it was a small church, and they had wooden benches and no padded pews, and they didn't have air conditioner. And so in the summer, they would have these old-time gospel meetings, and, you know, the preachers would preach like an hour or so. And the old people got those funeral home fans. Well, the kids didn't get them. So I can remember sitting as close to my grandfather as I could, you know, hoping I'd get some of that fan. And a couple of things I remember, they would open the windows, and as a kid, I was probably 7 or 8 years old. I remember the lightning bugs flying in and out of the window, and I wasn't paying any attention to the preacher, but I was just watching the lightning bugs, hoping I could catch one. What I remember most is the guy up on the stage that was a preacher, he had an oscillating fan blowing on him. And I remember, I can vividly remember as an 8-year-old boy thinking, that's where I got my call to the ministry right there. I thought, if I can get an oscillating fan blowing on me, it'll be a pretty good life. And it has been for the most part. So some things I wish everybody knew about grief. This is the book that we put together, Beyond the Valley of Death, Comforting Thoughts When I've Lost My Spouse. And I ordered 100 of those books, and they were supposed to arrive yesterday at Richard's house, and they didn't get here, and I don't know if they'll get here today, but everybody that's here should get at least one of those books. And if you want to have another one to give to somebody, and if you have friends that you'd like to give them to, or if you want some extras, write down your name and mailing address and hand it to me today. We charge nothing for those books. Through the Jenkins Institute, we published 40 books. Most of them are for preachers. And we charge people for books. I'll accept this one. A man said, I want everybody who wants one to have one. And so he pays for those books to be printed. So we're happy to make them available. Some things I wish everybody knew about grief. In case you weren't here last night, I'm just going to run through. I won't spend a lot of time on the first few points. Number one, grief is never the same. And by that we mean there are two directions where grief is never the same. Number one, grief is never the same for any two people. No two people experience grief in the same way, and no two people handle grief in the same way. And this is important for us because sometimes there will be people who have dealt with grief, and they will try to tell us how we should handle grief. And they mean well. They're not trying to be unkind or anything like that, but they think they've got it figured out, and they know how they experience grief, and so they try to tell you how you should deal with grief. And the problem with that is, as you know, none of us are the same, and we don't handle anything in life the same way that everybody else does. And so there's some people that can make you feel bad if you're not to a certain place in your grief journey and you're not as far along as they think that you should be. And so they'll try to tell you, I want to give you some ways that I can help you with that. And I say all of that to say, however you feel about grief and wherever you are at this moment in your grief journey, that's where you should be for you. It doesn't mean everybody else will be there or everybody else will handle it the way you handle it. But all of us who are on this journey are at a different place, and nobody should say, I've got it all figured out, and here's what you need to be doing. And if somebody tries to tell you that, if you were here last night, you'll understand this. You just go right ahead and punch them in the face, okay? And tell them that Jeff's grandson said you could do that. So, number one, no two people handle grief the same way. And number two, no two grief experiences are the same in our lives as individuals. Some of you who are here today have lost children. Some of you have lost parents. Some of you have lost maybe grandchildren. And many of you maybe have lost your mate. You've lost close friends and brothers and sisters. And you've gone through times in your own life that were difficult moments that had nothing to do with a physical loss. And so the point is that you understand that no two grief experiences are the same. I was telling you a little bit last night about my first experience with grief was when I lost my grandfather when I was about 10 years old. And I'll never forget that. I was a young boy, but I remember that. And then I lost one of my best friends in high school. We played football together, and he was killed in a tragic automobile accident on the way home from football practice one night. And my wife and I lost other friends and family members, and then my wife and I got married, and 3 years later, we had a child, and the child lived about 15 minutes and didn't survive. And then I lost my mother, and then I lost my father, and then 4 years ago, I lost my wife. And the point is that none of those were exactly the same. Every grief experience is different. And one of the reasons that every grief experience is different is because we learn through the grief process how to better handle maybe the next moment of grief. And so no grief is ever the same. Number two, grief is not just about death. Many people experience grief in other dimensions of life that don't have anything to do with death. A loss of a job, a loss of income, a loss of a reputation, a loss of a friendship, a divorce, separation between parents and children. All of those could be a form of grief. Caring for a person for a long period of time who passed away carries its own weight of grief, even in the process. I was talking to a lady the other day, and her mother has lived to be 92 years of age, and she is in good health. And but she's in good health generally, but she can't hardly do anything for herself. And so her daughter is doing everything for her. And she said, it's like every single day I learn something new I've got to do. And it's a kind of grief period for her. And so taking care of somebody has its own grief. So grief is not just about death. Number three, grief affects us in every dimension of our life. It affects us emotionally. We have emotions that come into our life when grief occurs that we do not, we don't know what to do with them. We don't know how to, we have no explanation for those emotions that come into our life. People start crying and they can't quit and they don't know why. Well, I mean, ultimately we know why, but we don't know what to do with that. We don't know how to stop that. And so it affects us. It affects us cognitively, the way we think, the decisions that we make, the choices that we make, being able to focus. It affects us behaviorally. Again, the things that we do, we will find ourselves doing things that we don't understand. It affects us physically. People can become physically ill. They sleep too much, they sleep too little, and then, of course, it can affect us spiritually. And people say, I don't go to church like I used to. I'm not involved in the church like I used to. And I don't understand that. And so it affects us in every dimension of our life. People who are grieving have numerous questions. There's the why question. Why did this have to happen? Why did this happen to this person and not happen to me? There's the what question. What can I do now? There's the what could we have done different? There's the how question. How can I move forward? So we have all of these questions that run through our mind. And I don't know about in your experience, but those questions crop up in my mind every once in a while, even questions that came to my life early after I lost my wife. So we have numerous questions. All right, so that's where we got to last night, and I want to move on a little bit further this morning. What we learn is that oftentimes people do not know how to respond to grief. They don't know how to respond. They don't know what to say. They don't know what to do. And part of this, we talked about last night, the fact is that we spend a lot of time talking about life and about things we do in this life, but we don't talk a lot about death. And we don't know, we don't talk about what to do when you lose somebody close to you. And so people mean well. You remember in the Bible the story of Job? And you remember about those three friends, Eliphaz, Zophar, those friends of his who came to comfort him? You remember what happened? They sat there for a week and didn't say a word. Now, some people kind of get onto those guys. My thought is, guess what? They were there. And sometimes it's not about what you say. And sometimes we'd be better off than say anything. Sometimes it's about just being there. And oftentimes people don't know what to say when somebody has experienced the most difficult moment in their life. And people can become, I have a friend who talks about being discombobulated. They're kind of confused. They don't know what to say. I'll tell you a story about that. My grandson was in a school play, a performance, and they were going to sing some songs. And so I drove to Oklahoma to see him, and they had it was a preschool performance, and they had these risers, and he was up on a riser, and they would sing, and they had he was standing next to a cute little girl who had red hair like my wife and his grandmother, and the next morning I took him to school. And when I take him to school, we always stop and have a donut for breakfast. His parents really love me for that, you know. But I don't care, so I let him have two donuts if he wants them. And then I tell the parents. So we stopped to get our donut, and so I was trying to make conversation with him. And I said, "Forrest, I said, that was a cute little redhead you were sitting next to, or you standing next to, in the performance last night." His eyes got real big, and he said, "Pops," he said, "I like the way she talks." I thought, okay, I don't know what that means. And I said, "So does that mean she's your girlfriend?" And he said, "Oh, no, Pops, she's not my girlfriend. I wouldn't kiss her." He's 4 years old. And then he said, "But boys are supposed to kiss girls, aren't they?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "But they're not supposed to kiss boys." And he said, "But I kiss my brother, and he's a boy. But that's different than kissing some other boy. And boys should kiss girls." And he just kept getting more and more confused. And finally, he said, "Pops, I just want to kiss a cow." So I think sometimes, you know, people get a little bit confused, and they don't know what to say. They don't know. They don't know. What we need to hear. They don't know how to help us. And then I wrote down some of the things that people say. And by the way, when you deal with grief in your life, there will be some people who will disappoint you. And it might be people who are close friends, and they could even be family members. When my wife passed away, Brother Larry, my elders called me in it was on a Sunday after the funeral. They called me in and said, "We want to meet with you." And they said, "We want you to take 3 months off. You've been working here for 17 years. You've given us your whole life for 17 years, and we want you to take some time off. And we want you to go visit family and friends and just get away and be able to come back refreshed." And then they said, "We want to ask you one thing. Don't make a major decision about your future work for at least 1 year." And so I said, "Okay, I'll agree with that part." I said, "I don't know if I can do 3 months. I can't stand to not be here that long." But I did take about a month away, and I visited all my family and friends during that month, and they said, "We'll take care of everything. If somebody calls you for a funeral, tell them you can't, you're out of town." And so we did that for a month, and I was with a family member one day, and we were driving around, and he got a phone call, and he was talking to the other person. I couldn't hear what the other person on the line was saying, but I could tell they were talking about me. And he must have said, how is Jeff doing?" And my family member said, "Oh, he's doing great." Well, that flew all over me. That made me angry because I was not doing great. Well, I think I know what he meant. He meant he's doing okay for what he's been through. But when I heard him say he's doing great, I did want to punch him in the face because I wasn't doing great. And it wasn't like I wanted other people to know necessarily that. But if you've just lost your spouse within a month and you're doing great, then you're not grieving. You're not dealing with the grief process. And the fact is that some people think there's something wrong with grieving. You know, some people think you ought to be happy all the time, no matter what's happened in your life. You ought to always be smiling. You ought to be happy all the time. And everything in life is great. You know, everything is wonderful. Well, that's not reality. The truth is, and we will go through moments of our time when we don't feel great and we're not doing so well. So some people think there's a problem with grief. But the fact is, the Bible tells us that grief is good. And if we do it the right way, it's a good thing for our life. Remember what Paul said to the Thessalonian Christians in 2 Thessalonians chapter 4? Remember these words? Sorrow not like those who have no hope. Okay, Paul didn't say don't grieve, but he said if you're a Christian and you're on, God is on your side, you won't grieve in the same way that other people will grieve. Because you'll have something that's in you that will in some way help you be able to deal with that grief correctly. So what do we do? You know, so I said to this man after he got off the phone, I said, I appreciate you for spending this time with me, but please don't tell people I'm doing great, because I'm not doing great. People won't always know what to say, and they'll let you down. So we have to work to be prepared to give other people grace, to work through hurt and frustrations. And there will be forgiveness that has to be given because of the reactions of other people. And the truth is, it's difficult to know what to say to somebody who's grieving. So I made a list of things that people said to me that I thought it might help if we could somehow educate. And one of the things I think people ask me all the time, what can the church do? What can the church do? Well, maybe we can help people by educating them about things that are not the best things to say. Like number one on my list, time heals all wounds. You hear that? You heard that before? You're going to be okay because time heals all wounds. I hate to tell you this, but that's theologically incorrect. Because time does not heal wounds. Time can help us learn how to navigate the journey that we're involved with, and it can help us learn to cope with our new, what we sometimes call, you heard people talk about the new normal in life. My life is not what it used to be, and it will never be normal like I remember normal. And so what do? You have to figure out this new normal that you don't like, right? Who likes this? And so the fact is, time does not heal wounds. And then people say, grief takes time. And I want to say, duh. Yeah. Grief takes a lot of time. I mentioned last night, people ask me sometimes, how long does it take you to start feeling great and normal again? And my answer is, I don't know. It's only been 4 years. And I've had people tell me that they lost their spouse 20 years ago. They still have daily pain in their heart and in their life. And even people, and we'll talk later today after lunch about what we can do to move beyond the valley of death, what we can do to move beyond that. People remarry and people do other things, and that's good and well, but still you're going to have this place, this empty spot in my heart. As long as I live, whether I ever choose to remarry or not, there'll be an empty place in my heart, and that'll never go away. And you know what? I don't want it to go away, because memory is a gift from God. And what would we do without, I mean, some memories you think about, I could sit here and think of some memories and it'd tear me up. And there are other memories I think about, and I think about how much joy that brought into life and to our family. A memory can be a blessing and a curse. I go to Red River, New Mexico every year. They have a family encampment there. And if you've never been, you ought to think about going. It's a beautiful place, and there'll be 1,500 to 2,000 Christians there and singing and classes and worship. And I speak every year at this family encampment. Well, last year, I'd been begging my daughter and her husband and my three grandchildren to go. And so I'm friends with the guy who directs it. And I said, I'm looking for a teacher for the high school and college section. I said, I know a guy, my son-in-law. And I said, why don't you invite him? And so he did. So they came last year, and they loved it. And so he got invited back this year. Well, last year, I don't know if you've ever been to Red River, but they have a ski lift that goes up to about 10,000, nearly 11,000 feet. And you ride the ski lift up. And so we were going to ride the ski lift. And so we got on the ski lift and rode it up. And we got up there and it started storming. Well, they won't let you come down when it's lightning. And they have to have at least 20 minutes between lightning strikes to let you come down the hill. Well, we were stuck up there for about 2.5 hours. And I was supposed to speak that evening. I was getting a little bit concerned about that. But it wasn't frightening or anything. It wasn't scary or life-threatening. At least I didn't think it was. Well, this year we got there and we were sitting down on Main Street and we were having ice cream, and one of the grandchildren, I think my granddaughter, said, look, the ski lift is open. Let's go up there. And my youngest grandson said, I don't want to go up there. He said, because that's where we almost died last year. well, we didn't almost die. But in his mind, that was his memory, you know, that was his memory. And there were times when, shortly after I lost my wife, in my memory, I thought, I'm going to die too. And you know, there is a statistic that says that many times, especially in their older years, that when one spouse dies, the other one will die within 2 years of time. That's a number that's real in the lives of many people. And there were times I thought, I want to die, you know. I'm not fatalistic or anything, but I don't want to live here with like this. And I think the longer you live, in some ways, the more you're able to say, I will continue to live. So time doesn't heal wounds. Grief takes time. Time goes by, and it allows us to become used to the feeling of that emotional pain. And it's not so much that time doesn't heal wounds, but it's what we do with our time moving forward. Another thing that people would say oftentimes, and this one was one I wish people would not say, they would say to me, now Jeff, you just got to take one day at a time. You ever hear that before? Just take one day. Well, you know, generally that sounds good, but when you're in a moment of grief, you're thinking, one day at a time. How about one step at a time? How about 1 minute? How about one breath at a time? Because it's not so much, you're not worried about tomorrow. You're worried about how am I going to get through today? And so people should think about one day at a time. So I was doing a seminar, and I was talking about these things that people say. And by the way, if you're willing, if you would share with me things that you think people say that are not helpful, I think we can help spread the word. I would love to hear what you have heard that you thought was not helpful. And I would also like to hear what you heard from people that has been helpful. If you'd be willing to write those down, you could send me an email or hand them to me before we leave. We'll be doing probably 14 of these seminars next year, and we want to help people as much as possible. So people say, I was doing this in a seminar, and somebody said, why don't you tell us what people say that's helpful? So I got to asking people, and here's what people said. The thing that was most helpful was, I love you. Just tell people that you love them. You don't have to say a lot beyond that. just knowing that other people care. And then say, some people would say, if there's anything I can do for you, please let me know. Now that's a well-meant statement, but that's pretty generic. And so somebody said, tell them, ask them something specific. Can I come over and mow your yard for you? Can I come over and run some errands for you? Can I come and take you to the doctor? Or ask people specific things that you can do, because that's real to them. You know, when people say, if there's anything I can do, give me a call. Well, that's good, but it's better if you can say, can I help you with this? Could we bring some folks over from church and help them help you clean your house if you need that? Can we bring a meal tomorrow night? So be specific when you ask people. And then the third big thing is just be there for people. Let them know. Contact them regularly. Call them. Ask people how they're doing. And so it's important for us to recognize that we need to try to offer, those of us who are going through grief, a need to try to offer grace to people who don't understand, who don't know what we're dealing with. Okay, what have we done? Your battery is running low. Yeah, my battery runs low a lot of times. All right, next on the list. Grief is cyclical. Grief is cyclical. By that we mean that, and we'll talk about this even more in the next point, but it's almost like it's a circle where you don't go from point to point to point, or from stage to stage to stage, or season to season, but there has to be movement. There has to be movement. I don't know if it's this battery or the battery on the computer. It could be this one. The key during challenging times is movement. And when we stop moving, that's when grief becomes overbearing to us. I have to stay busy in my life. If I sit down for too long, that's when I start really feeling sorry for myself. And that's where I lose focus, and I don't know what's next, and it's difficult to go on. And so if you stop moving, and I'm not just talking about necessarily physically moving, although that's important. If you don't let your mind move, and you don't let your heart move, and you don't let your spirit move, then you're going to suffer even more difficulty. One person said that our next step is just to take the next step. I have to put one foot in front of the other. We know that there will be challenging moments in our life, but we have to prepare ourselves for those next moments. The next one on the list is that grief is gradual. Grief is gradual. Now, we're going to spend some time here this morning. Grief is gradual. When I was in school at Fried Hardeman, I took some counseling classes, and I had a minor in counseling, and one of the books that was required reading was a book called The Five Stages of Grief, written by Kubler-Ross and David Kessler. And it's still, that book was written probably in the 60s or 70s, and it's still kind of the gold standard, we say, for helping people. And if you enjoy reading, I'm going to give you some other books to encourage you to read that will be helpful. But this book ought to be on the list, even though it's kind of a little bit antiquated, a little dated. It still should be on the list. And Kubler-Ross says that she calls it five stages of grief. Five stages. Now, in my book, I talk about what I call the five seasons of grief. They're the same, but I call them seasons instead of stages, because when I think of five stages of grief, I think about like a performance or a play, and you have act one, and they get off the stage, and then act two comes on, and that goes off the stage, and then act three, and there's always a progression, and you know exactly what's going to happen. But in seasons, it's like, you know, seasons come and go, and they don't always stay gone. Some parts of the country, you know, they have something called like blackberry winter. You know that, what that is? So you can think that winter's almost gone and spring can come, and then all of a sudden one of those nor'easters comes through and temperature can drop about 70 degrees in a few hours. And you thought, well, I'd already put up my coats. I thought we were over that. And seasons come and go, but they don't always stay gone. And sometimes seasons will interact with one another. We say in Dallas, in Texas, we have like 3.5 seasons. Summer, and then like late summer, and then we have fall, and then we have a little bit of winter, like for 2 days or something like that. And sometimes they overlap. Well, that's the thing about the seasons of grief. And so I want to share with you the five seasons of grief. And no matter how long you've been grieving, whether you've been grieving for a week or for 40 years, you are in one of these seasons of grief, even today. You're in one of these seasons. And they don't always go in order. This is important to understand. It's not like I'm going to give you five seasons and this is the order that they'll always go in. This is the order generally that they'll go in. And I've known people who don't go through the first season. They immediately go to the second season, and then later on they'll wonder what happened and they'll go back to the first season. So what are the five seasons? Number one, the first season of grief is denial. It is denial. When you lost your spouse, at the very first, it was like you didn't want to accept that it had happened. You didn't want to believe it. My wife passed away on a Thursday morning, very early in the morning. On Wednesday night, her parents had come in, and you know this, you've heard this. You know, parents are not supposed to bury their children. But her parents came in, and her brother, and they came to the house, and we all gathered in the bedroom, and all the children, my two children were there, and my grandchildren were there, and Laura's parents and her brother were there. And we had a devotion on Wednesday night. And my wife had not said anything all day that day. The day before, she had talked a little bit, but we knew that she didn't have long left. That's why her parents came. And that night, we were singing songs, and my wife had not spoken all day. And I looked over during one of those songs. I was on the bed sitting next to where she was lying, and I could see her mouthing the words to those songs. She was singing those songs. And I remember thinking at that moment, I can't believe this is going to happen. And when it happens, you sometimes want to deny that it happened. And another term is, you heard of people say that they're in a state of shock. You know what that means? That's when they say things like I told you about this woman who lost her husband, who was a preacher, and only the first thing out of her mouth was, I don't know what dress to wear to the funeral. And she kept saying that over and over again. And every time somebody would come to the room and recognize that he had passed away, she said, I don't know what dress to wear to the funeral. She just kept saying that over. You know what that was? She was in a state of shock. And I think that this, I've tried to figure out what are these seasons for? What good do they do? Well, shock and denial help us get to through the original moments and make decisions that have to be made, and we have still a little bit of the composure to be able to do that. So a lot of times when people would lose loved ones back through the years, I would say to them, you know, they'd say, we want you to do the funeral. And I would say, what if I meet you and your family at the funeral home when you're going through the process and everything that's going on? And they would appreciate that. And I would see people who had lost a spouse the day after they lost their spouse sitting at the funeral home and making all these major life decisions. And they were able to do that. Well, how were they able to do that? I think they were able to do that because they were kind of in this season of denial and shock. And so it may be, in one way, God's gift to us to be able to help us get through those initial days to make survival possible. And so I've had people who lost a spouse that they had been married to for 50 years, and they sit at the funeral and they don't cry. And then days later, they start crying and they can't quit because they were in that state of that season of shock. And so one writer calls it the grace of denial. It's nature's way of letting in only as much as we can handle. And as we accept the reality of the loss and start to ask questions of ourselves, we unknowingly begin a healing process. Number one season is denial. Number two is anger, the season of anger. And again, it's necessary for the healing process. And it's okay to feel anger, even though there'll be times that anger feels endless. Did you know that anger is not a sin? You know, the Bible says, be angry and do not sin. So anger can turn into something that is sinful if we allow bitterness in our heart, and if we allow it to overtake us in a long term kind of way. But anger itself is not sinful. The Bible talks about the wrath of God. You know what that is? That's anger. Jesus walked into the temple, and he took a whip and he ran the money changers out of the temple. You know what that was? That was anger. So anger is not sinful, but it's a part of the healing process. And the more we feel it, anger, and if we handle it correctly, we will get through that. Anger is an emotion that we can learn to handle. And the truth is that when we're angry, when we're in the season of anger, there are no limits to it. So people are angry. How many times have you heard somebody say, When they think the doctor's made the wrong decision? I've heard this numerous times in my life. The doctors did this wrong, and the hospital did this wrong, and I'm going to sue the hospital. I've heard many, many people say that. That's anger. And it's a part of the process. And it can extend to doctors, and it can be we can be angry at family. You know how when you lose somebody close to you and all the family comes in and everybody's helping and they're there to do whatever you need them to do. They cook meals. They run errands. And then after a few days, what happens? They go home. And you're still there. And you're still there by yourself. And I had my family came, my children, my grandchildren. I had some friends who came and stayed about 3 days, and they were so kind, and I appreciated that. And then everybody left. And I was sitting there in that big house by myself, and I didn't know what to do next. And I got angry with those people. So why did they leave? Well, the reason they left is they had to go back to work. You know, they had a life that they had to live. But all I could think about was, why were they not here for me at this very moment? So anger is can extend to family. I've known people who were angry at the person who passed away. Why did he leave me like this? Why did she have to leave me now? And then people become angry at themselves. And guess what? People even become angry with God. You know, God, why did you let this happen? Why did you let this happen? I used to pray years ago when we were young married, the more we got to know each other, I used to pray that I would outlive my wife. I prayed that. You know why? Because I didn't want her to have to take care of me. Because I'd be a lousy patient. And I would not be a fun kind of person to have to take care of. And then when she got sick, I remember thinking, I don't know if I prayed this prayer, but I remember thinking, I don't want to outlive her anymore. I want to go when she goes. Anger can even be turned on ourselves. Underneath the feelings of desertion and abandonment, there is fear. But anger can be strength, and it can be an anchor, and it can give us some kind of temporary structure in the nothingness of loss. Number three, the first season is denial. The second is anger. And you would think that it would go in this order all the time. But like I said, sometimes there will be anger, or sometimes somebody will skip denial and go straight to anger. Immediately upset with everybody. And so then they'll come back to denial. The third season is what Kubler-Ross calls bargaining. Bargaining. And here's what I want to read you what she says about this. Before a loss, it seems like you will do anything if only your loved one would be spared. And so you pray, please God, and you bargain with God. I'll never be angry at my wife again if you'll just let her live. I'll never treat them this way again if you'll just let them live. I will commit more to our relationship. And after loss, she said, bargaining takes the form of a temporary truce. And then you start saying, God, give me the strength. You bargain with God, if it were, give me the strength to be able to carry on in my life, to make the kind of decisions I need to make. And so you bargain with God. And we become lost in a maze of, we're not careful, of if only or what if statements. And we want life to return to the way it was. We want our loved one back. One of the things I heard people say sometimes after my wife died, well, you wouldn't want to bring her back to this, to the pain she was in. And she's in heaven. You believe she's in heaven. You wouldn't want to take her away from that. Well, I did. I wanted to bring her back. And call it selfish or whatever you want to call it. That's what I wanted to do. So bargaining is an important part of the process of grief. Number four is depression. After anger and denial and bargaining, our attention moves away from what has happened to what is now, the reality of what is now. And empty feelings can present themselves, and grief enters our lives on a deeper level, deeper than we ever imagined. I remember thinking when my wife passed away, you know, in a year from now, things will be better. That first year anniversary, it seems like to me that things were more difficult then than they had been the whole year before that. And you know how anniversaries and birthdays and special holidays, my wife's favorite holiday was Thanksgiving. She loved to cook a traditional Thanksgiving meal, and we'd have family there, and we always had a thing. We would invite people from church to come who didn't have family who lived in the area, and she loved, that was her favorite holiday. And she passed away in June in 2019, and my daughter called me about September, and she said, Dad, she said, I know you don't have room for us to have Thanksgiving in your house, and she said, I don't think I can do that. She said, I'm not in a place where I can cook a big meal and have a lot of people in. And I said, well, I said, why don't we just go somewhere and we'll rent a house, in a place, and we'll just spend a few days together during that time. And if we want to cook, we'll cook. If we want to go out to eat, we'll go out to eat. And she said, I would love that. And so we went to Broken Bow, Oklahoma. It's kind of a little resort area, and there's a lot of cabins there. And by the way, when I say, why don't we rent a house, it means, why don't I rent a house? You know, so I rented a house, and both of my children came. My son, I hadn't talked about my son much. My son is an attorney, and he lives in Brooklyn, New York. And he's been such a blessing since my wife passed away. Their office has an office in Dallas, and so occasionally he'll come to work just to be able to be around me. And the last time he came, he said, Dad, I'm not coming back. I said, why not? He said, because you're not home. But he came, and my daughter came, and my grandchildren came, and we had a wonderful about 4 days together. And we ended up cooking a traditional meal. We all pitched in and did the cooking. And we sat around, and we told stories about Lolly. My wife's name is Laura, and one of the first grandchild couldn't say Laura, so she said Lolly. So they started calling her Lolly, and they called me Pops. And I was flying to South Africa, and we stopped in Dubai, and there was this massive mall, one of the tallest buildings in the world, and there was a mall in there. And I went over there and started walking around. I had a 9-hour layover. I started walking around that mall, and there was a store that said Lolly and Pops on that store. And I sat there and cried for about 30 minutes. But we told stories about her. And about Christmas time when we got together, my daughter said, Dad, can we do that again next year? I said, sure. And so this Thanksgiving will be our fifth Thanksgiving together. I've saved just enough money by living in hotels that I can pay for the house I have to rent for a week. But it's a very special time. And so depression, empty feelings, grief gets deeper. We want to withdraw from life. We feel like there's an intense sadness. We wonder if there's any point in going on alone. Why go on at all? Depression after a loss is too often seen as unnatural, but it is not unnatural. The first question we have to ask is whether the situation you're in is depressing. The loss of a loved one can be a very depressing situation, and it's a normal and appropriate response. So it is natural. And when the loss begins to settle into your soul, the realization that your loved one didn't get better this time is not coming back is very depressing. And so people say, is it wrong for me to take medicine if I need it? Well, I'm not a doctor. Like my granddaughter said, I'm a preacher, and I'm not a psychiatrist or a psychologist, but I don't think it's wrong to take medicine. I think God allowed doctors to create medicine to help us, and if it helps you get better. Now, if we become dependent on any medicine to the degree that we can't function, that can be a problem. But one of my biggest struggles in life at this moment in my life is getting enough sleep. I don't sleep well, and part of it's because I'm old. When I lived in Oklahoma, I was a young preacher, and they had this preacher's breakfast on Thursday mornings at 6 o'clock, and it was all I could do to get out of bed to get there to that breakfast, but I didn't want to miss it. And all these old guys, they had these old preachers who were like 60, yeah, and they talk about getting 3 or 4 hours of sleep at night. And I remember thinking, what's wrong with you? Well, guess what? I understand now. And one of the reasons I don't sleep at night is because I sleep in a different bed every night. And usually about the second night, I could get a little comfortable and sleep a little bit better. But the problem is most hotels I don't stay two nights in. So I don't get a lot of sleep. And it causes you to wonder, you know. And so I went to my doctor for my annual checkup. I have four stents in my heart that were put in there last year. And I went for my checkup, and he said, "It looks like you're doing great. Everything's fine. What kind of problems you have?" I said, "I don't sleep at night." He said, "I'm going to give you some medicine." And he said, "This is natural." He said, "It's a natural pill." And he said, "By the way," he said, "you do a lot of flying." And I said, "Yes." And I was going to South Africa, and it's about a 20-hour flight. You stop to refuel sometimes, but it's about a 20-hour flight. And I was, he said, "If he said, "I'm going to tell you what to do. Get on the plane and get your meal and read a little bit, watch a movie, and then take one of these pills, and you will go to sleep." And I said, "Promise?" And he said, "Guaranteed." So I got on the plane, I got my meal, I was reading a book, I did a little bit of writing, and I took that pill, and it didn't faze me. I wonder if I got the wrong pill. Well, it didn't help me a bit. And I didn't sleep. I stayed awake the whole time. I got tired, but I couldn't get comfortable, so I couldn't sleep. So they picked me up at the airport, and I was speaking at a lectureship at the South African Bible School in Johannesburg, and they picked me up at the airport, and they drove me straight to the church building. I'd been on a plane for 20 hours with no sleep, and it was time for me to speak, and they were singing the song right before it was time for me to get up, and I walked in, and I sat down on the front row, and that pill hit me. To this day, I'm not sure what I said that night. I don't know. I was completely out of it. So I say all that to say, if you need medicine, and you know, talk to your doctor and trust the knowledge and the wisdom that God has given them. And depression can last a long time. I know people who live constantly in a state of depression, and they have for years and years and years. And they take medicine, and it helps them, and they learn to cope, and so it can last a long time. Season number five, there's denial and anger and bargaining and depression. And number five is acceptance. Now, acceptance, let me clarify, does not mean that everything is okay. You just come to a place where you accept that this is the way my life is going to be. And, you know, you may meet somebody else, and you may choose to marry, but acceptance says, I understand what has happened in my life. It doesn't mean everything is all right. It doesn't mean everything is going to be okay. Most people will probably never feel all right again. This stage is about accepting the reality that our loved one is physically gone and recognizing that this new reality is going to be my life. We may never be in love with that new reality. My life at this point is so different than it was 5 years ago. If anybody would have told me 5 years ago that I would be where I am now and I would be doing what I'm doing now, I would have looked at them like they had nine heads. But it's the reality of where I am. And while I love what I do, I don't like the reality of the fact that I'm without my wife. And so we learn to live with what has happened. It's a new normal, if you will. We try to live now in a world where our loved one is missing. At first, we may try to resist this. But in time, through bits and pieces of acceptance, we'll see that we cannot maintain the past intact. Here's one thing I know, that if you've lost a spouse, your life will never be the same again. It'll never be exactly like it was. You may choose to remarry and you may be happy. And if you are and you have, or you do, praise God for that. and congratulations, but your life is still never going to be exactly like it was before. Our life will never be the same. And as we begin a new life and hopefully learn to enjoy that life, we sometimes feel like that we're betraying the person that has gone on. I was speaking in January of this year in North Carolina, and a lady came up to me during a break and said, "Can I talk to you for a minute?" And we went into a classroom, and she said, "I never felt anger." She said, "My husband has been gone for 3 years now, and I've never felt anger. And you said that anger is one of the seasons of grief, and I was thinking about this earlier, even before you said this." She said, I feel guilty that I've never felt anger. Is there something wrong with me?" And I said, "No." I said, maybe you didn't go through that season. Maybe it wasn't meant for you to go through that season. And you've accepted where you are now." And she said, "I've struggled with moving on because I felt like I need to be angry." And then she said, "I'm angry at myself for not being angry." Took her by the shoulder. I said, "Get a hold of yourself." No, I didn't. I didn't say that. We come to a place where it doesn't mean that everything is going to be the same or that everything is all right, but we come to accept that this is the way life is going to be. And so those are the five seasons of grief. And David Kessler, who co-wrote the book with Kubler-Ross, later on wrote a second book. And he calls it The Sixth Stage of Grief. And the book is, I think it's called Finding Meaning Again. And what he does is, he says, when you get to the place of acceptance and you start to live in acceptance, there are some ways that you can find meaning in your life again. And what we're going to do after lunch is I'm going to talk about, and these are not necessarily in the book, some of them have images that are in the thoughts that he presents, but these are my own that I've developed, some things that we can do in our life to find meaning again. And that's what we'll talk about after lunch. A couple of things. Number one, thank you for coming today. I know that some of this is not easy to hear. It's not easy to think about. But I think in the long run, it can be helpful for us to think about and to know that other people are thinking about some of the same kind of things that we deal with. And to know that we're not alone. Every person in this room that has dealt with any kind of grief is on this journey with us. We're not alone. We'll talk about that more after lunch. So number one, thank you. Number two, if there's some question you have about something that we've discussed, or even something maybe that we have not discussed, if you'll write that question down and hand it to me, we'll talk about it we've got a list of a question and answer period. I've done seminars where nobody had a question that they wanted answered. And you know what that means? That means you get to go home early. So that's okay. I did one seminar that the question and answer period lasted for over an hour. I'll be here as long as we need to. And if you have a question you'd like to have discussed, write it down and hand it to me, or hand it to Brother Larry, if you will, and we will deal with it in the that. And if you don't have questions, then we'll do the next part, and then we'll be dismissed for the day. So thank you. Questions. And number three, if you're taking any notes, would you do this? Would you write down my email address? For a couple of reasons. Number one, I would love to hear your comments about things that people said to you that were not helpful and things that people said to you that were helpful. And number two, I would love to hear what you think we could do in a seminar like this to help other people in a better way. My address is Jeff A. Jenkins. Jeff, the letter A, Jenkins, all small, no capitals, @gmail.com. And then I want to give you one other thing, my phone number. You can call me or text me. I do a lot of texting. If you have things you'd like to ask, please feel free. It's 972-977-9871. And a guy said to me at a seminar in Kansas, "You're stupid for giving out your phone number." And I said, "Why?" He said, "People are going to bother you." And I said, "People bother me all the time." I said, "I don't think any of these people are going to call me and tell me they've got a new car warranty for me, so I think we'll be okay." 972-977-9871. Feel free to reach out to me if you want to talk, if you have questions, if I can help you in any way. I want to do that. We'll talk about in the next session some things we can do as individuals, some things that we can do as a church that will help people through some of the most difficult days of our life. Let's have a prayer. Should we go ahead and have a prayer for the food now? Or would that be all right? I'll offer a prayer for the food, and then if there are other instructions, please pass them along. Father, we're thankful that you are the God of all comfort, and that you comfort us in all of our afflictions. And Father, I'm grateful today for each person in this room who's taken time from life to come and to listen and to think about grief. And Father, my prayer is that you'll bless each person individually. I know that there are people in this room who have suffered a horrible loss, maybe the loss that they thought they would never have to deal with recently, or maybe a long time ago. And Father, pray that you'll bless each one, wherever they are on this journey. Father, help us to encourage one another. Help us to love one another. Help us to be there for one another. Father, help us to not waste our pain, to use what we have dealt with in our life to maybe bring a little bit of comfort to others. Father, we're grateful for the church, for our family, our physical family, for our church family. And we pray, Father, that you would help us to be to one another and for one another what we need most. Father, most of all, help us, when we think about the church, help us especially just to be aware, to realize that there are people all around us who are hurting. We're grateful for the food that we'll enjoy. We ask for blessings upon those who have made it available. Thankful for the fellowship that we'll have. Pray that you'll bless us in the rest of our time together today. In the name of Jesus, we pray. Amen.